Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. This episode is a 10-page podcast all about one of his short stories. Get ready to enjoy our remarks. Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who enjoys duck comics, and I am joined by a very special first-time guest that I'm very excited to have on the show. I'm joined today by John Lustig, and we are going to be talking about one of Barks' all-time great 10-page stories for this episode of the 10-page podcast. So I'm going to ask him to introduce himself and tell us a little bit about his background with Carl Barks and with duck comics.
Okay. Hi, Mark. Well, I was a newspaper reporter, editor, photographer for a small newspaper chain for about the first 10 years of my working life. Previous to that, when I was in college, I actually sold my first comic book story to Western Publications, which was published at that time under Gold Key. I did a Daffy Duck five-pager, and then I got into doing newspapers, and I didn't have time to do ducks. I mean, comic books. And so after those 10 years, I've been writing comic books. And for about 25 of those years, I was writing duck stories, Disney duck stories. And I started out being teamed up with my friend Bill Van Horn. And I worked a little bit with Carl, sort of. That's complicated. And I met Carl a number of times. And after he died, I got to complete some of Carl's uncompleted stories, some of which have appeared here and some of which haven't. So, and unlike a lot of the hardcore duck fans and duck writers, let's say like Rosa or Van Horn, I did not really grow up on Barks. I read one Barks story I remember from when I was a kid. It was the 10 Cent Valentine, which was Magica Dispel's second appearance.
Oh, yeah.
And I enjoyed that. But I didn't know who Carl Barks was. And shortly after that, I discovered superheroes and I was buying comics for myself finally. So I was lost on superheroes until somewhere in my college years. And then I found a couple of Barks comics at a garage sale. And it was The Golden Helmet and A Trick or Treat. And I was an English major and a journalism major, that double major. And just as a writer, I was just totally blown away by those. I mean, I couldn't have been more surprised and shocked. And that's when I became a Barks fan. And so I approached this maybe from a little different perspective. It's not nostalgia for me. It's like, oh my God, these were particularly The Golden Helmet, which is my favorite Barks adventure. And it was like, and Trick or Treat's a fine story too, but it was like these are two of the best comic book stories, best stories period I've ever read. And I was just slack-jawed, dumbfounded, completely bowled over by it. Years later, when I got to meet Carl, I took those two comics with me, and I don't think he had ever had anybody, and these were the most beat up comics you could imagine.
Right. I mean, well loved.
Yeah. Well loved. And he picked them up and he just waved them in the air back and forth because they were like paper, obviously paper, but they were especially thin and floppy. And I don't think he'd ever had any comics in such bad shape that he'd been asked to sign. Most people were having signed probably because, you know, and that was fun. And I've still got those squirreled away somewhere in my collection. But anyway, and as I said, I did sort of collaborate with him on a story, and Pat Block drew that, and he did a great job on that. But there was some interference on the part of some people at the Bark Studio that kind of sent the story in a weird way away from what Carl had intended. And so years later, I, with my editor's approval, we redid that story as Somewhere Beyond Nowhere, and Don Yupis drew it, and I think it's much closer to what Carl liked, but it's unique to have two different versions, completely different versions of one of Carl's stories like that.
And yeah, and it seems like Don Yipis is usually involved when there are two different versions.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's so good, and he's such a huge Barks fan, and my editor is no longer working at the, unfortunately, Byron, as far as Erickson, as far as I know, is no longer editing at Gladstone, but Yipis was his favorite artist, and I supposedly was his favorite writer, so he wanted to team us together whenever possible. And Don drew all the little things that I did of Barks after that too. So
yeah, that's really neat. I came across that that you had done an additional version of it, kind of in looking up some background for the episode, and I haven't gotten to see that one, so I'd be really interested in checking that out. So I was just going to say, there's a lot to unpack in your opening, right? Because you are, as you mentioned, I've gotten to have Patrick Block on here. He's a fantastic artist. I've had a couple of other Duck creatives, Henrique Hurhaus and Joachim, the editor at Egmont. I think he's done some art as well. But you're the first time I've had someone on who's done Duck writing. And I wanted to acknowledge that I'm a really big fan. You know, you mentioned the Gladstone era.
Just chuckling and appreciating your appreciation. Since you mentioned the Gladstone era, you were getting into that. There are only three freelancers brought on at Gladstone, and Gladstone won the first version.
Right.
First was Rosa, then it was Van Horn, and I was friends with Bill, and we sort of worked together a little bit. He used some of my plots on the last issue of his own series called Nervous Rex.
Nervous Rex, yeah.
And I actually, since Bill doesn't travel for the most part, I was sort of his liaison when I went down to San Diego Comic-Con and talked to Gladstone and got information on how he could submit. And when Bill started doing stuff, then he was doing, you know, Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge. And then they asked him to do DuckTales. And he said, do you want to do some DuckTales with me? And so that's really where I started. Oh, wait a minute. Before that, I did a couple of one pagers and a couple of two pagers. And that's really a great way to start. Everybody, when they start writing, and I know it's true in the Duck world, but it's probably true in any established universe, comic universe, they want to do like 4 zillion different characters, and they want to do it a 48 page or 64 page story. Sure. And so forth. And, you know, but starting really small is great because it teaches you how to get just what you need in, and it helps teach you story structure too. So anyway, that's just my reflection on how to get started.
Those are great. It sounds like great writing tips to me. And I'm definitely interested in talking about story structure, you know, as we go through our story today. And I don't want to wax on too much about it, but like you mentioned Beat Up Comics, you know, I think it's blurring
out on my,
but this is the issue.
Yeah.
That this was probably one of the like first three or four comics that I ever read.
And for people who aren't us, who don't see the video, you're talking about, I think it's DuckTales number 7.
Yeah.
Windfall on Mount Gesundheit. I don't remember all my titles, but I remember that one.
That's such a memorable title to me. And it's such a zany story. Right. And And those, that collaboration that you and it's funny to me to think of him as Bill. Of course, I think of him as William Van Horn.
Right.
But no, no. You and William Van Horn had such a great collaboration. I have really grown to appreciate his stories over the years. When I saw them originally, they didn't always grab me the way that I. Right. There's a certain like anarchist, goofy, really oddball sensibility to them that's just incredibly unique and very funny.
Glad to hear you say that. Yeah, I think Bill has this different approach. And although he's done long stories, and I've done a few long stories, most of our work is in shorter pieces. And Bill is all about the zany.
Yes.
And the goofball. And Bill is, like Barks, got his training as an animator.
Right.
I think that affects both of their work very much so. But Bill's favorite comic was Crazy Cat.
Oh, and well, that's obvious, right?
Right, right. And if you look at Bill's own series, his Nervous Rex, which is being reprinted shortly, right. His style, his natural drawing style, is more in the Crazy Cat version. You know,
I'm glad you said that. I can definitely see a lot of Harriman, George Harriman, right? In that kind of swooping, very surrealistic, and I think you're writing.
And sometimes it'll change and even in Bill's duck stories, you can see him placing weird little things in the background. And Bart did a little bit of that where he'd have different like duck paintings in the background and you know like 4 zillion ducks in a picture hanging on the wall and so forth. But it's a very different approach than just about anybody else does.
Yeah, it's very unique, I think, in Disney comics. And it's rare to see someone who is not kind of trying to ape Barks, you know, for a good reason, right? Because he is the master. So like, I understand what you're talking about. There's something very kind of quiet and understated about that. Like, I keep coming back to the word anarchist, but like the Van Horn stories, they have these rules, but then he just constantly breaks them in a way that's very funny. Very like early Looney Tunes, very early Barks. I think one of my other guest hosts pointed out that he is like the heir of Barks' early stories.
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction to make as opposed to his later stuff and so forth. And Bill's ending to his stories tend to be very soft. In most cases, they don't have. Sometimes I wish they had a little more punch. And I think when we worked together, the stories had a little more punch. But that's Bill, and it's a very. And if you look at Crazy Cat, they would do the same thing. It's not characters punching each other at the end or you know pratfalls. It's just character just talking and a little bit of philosophy or wisdom or
they kind of trail irony. Off. Like
they trail off, and that's how. Bill's stories, not all of them, but some of them, a lot of them do. And you just have to appreciate it on a different level.
Right. I think so. All right. So thank you so much for indulging me in talking about, your own work. So as I mentioned, we get to talk about a really great story today. I think that most fans, if they were asked to name some of their favorite 10 pagers, there's a pretty good chance that people would name this one, in the first 10 or so.
I have, I was going to bring this in later, but are you going to bring in Index rating on this?
I do. I usually mention Index at the end, but you're welcome.
Okay, then I've got something to add to that when you get to that. So
yeah, absolutely.
Okay. But this is really a classic. This is one of the ones people always talk about. And, I was thrilled that you allowed me to do this one. It was one of a couple that we talked about me doing. And the other one was Flipism. And I've got all the Barks library, and I've got so many of these stories in like triplicate or quadruplet and so forth, but I pulled one of the color Barks albums, and I was shocked when I went through that in the, I think, five stories there. They've got three of my favorites. They've got Omelette, the Hypno Gun story, and Flipism, and that's all in a 6-month period. Carl was really hitting on all cylinders there, as far as I'm concerned. This is, I think, 52 into 53. Boy, I mean, what a great period.
Absolutely.
And I know that wasn't a happy, and that's also about the time that he did the Golden Helmet,
right?
Which I think is the great Barks long epic story. And it's the darkest of his stories too. But what a great period. You know, I mean, it apparently came out of a period where he was very unhappy. And it just shows you how you can kind of rise above that, but how sometimes so much comedy is based on pain to some degree. Yeah, it's just very interesting to me.
Yeah, you said it. What a great period of time for him. That's part of the details that I always mention. This one had a cover date of November of 1952, along with many of his other great stories around that span. It was originally published in Walt Disney's Comics and Stories number 146. It's had a pretty good number of reprints, as you might expect. And in the U.S., it's had 8 different reprints. And, they weren't titled originally. So there was a couple of proposed titles that have alternate titles people have used over the years until they kind of just settled on Omelette. But one alternate title was A Town Called Omelette. And I think a lot of the most memorable 10 pagers, John, can kind of be distilled down to their hook or their high concept, right? And like Flipism has the great coin flip element. By the way, that guy at the beginning of the story, that side character, he feels like such a Van Horn character to me.
I know,
as a random aside there, but this one, you know, it's the egg story, it's the chicken story. People know this story, and of course, a big part of why I think this one really hits for people is that Barks has such a personal connection to the story and to the concept, right? This was his backup when he was transitioning to taking up the comics full time. He reported feeling a little bit uneasy about putting all his eggs in the basket of comic book making. And so when he and his wife at the time moved out to San Jacinto, his backup was chicken farming.
Right.
And you get the sense from that he was writing out of personal experience, right?
Yeah. When we talked about me doing the broadcast, the two stories we were talking about was this one and Flipism. And both of them are kind of plot-based stories, particularly this one.
Yeah.
And I tend to prefer more character-based ones, but the structure on this one and the way it's plotted, and it's almost a blueprint to how Carl did stories, and then we'll talk about that later. But one of the other reasons I wanted to do it because I knew Carl was a chicken farmer,
right?
So some of this is like based on personal experience, and there's one panel in there that's so ironic once you know that. And what I didn't realize at the time until I started researching for this podcast was I didn't realize that this was often the story Carl picked as his favorite 10 pager.
Yeah. I encountered that same fact. And it's so funny. I have kind of a running thing where I track all of the stories that he has called his favorite over the years. Cause he did it for so long that of course he'd answer different ways, but you're right. Sure. When he talked about the 10 pagers, at least, this is usually the one that came up. And I think you can really feel his personal connection. It's easy to remember. It's easy to visualize him kind of thinking about his own experiences.
Sure. And it's such a goofy, funny concept that was the other thing. It's just a goofy story.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, before we actually dive into the story, I'm just going to read a quote from an interview he gave. Okay. He had said that when he left the studio, he really wanted to get to a drier climate because, quote, the air conditioning was knocking the hell out of my sinuses. And so he said that the only way he could think to make a living was to have chickens. And so he didn't want to have anything he had to take care of on a routine. And he said they made him a little bit of profit before he phased them out. But he ultimately found he couldn't take care of chickens as well as write and draw. And, you know, comics were what paid him more money. So thank goodness for that.
Right. And I think comics are not noted for being a particularly well-paying field. So anytime it pays better than your day job, quit your day job.
Right. Yeah, you've got to jump on that, I'm sure.
Right.
So, all right. So, John, we're going to jump into the meat of this iconic story. And I'm just going to kind of narrate some of the broad action on each page. And in between the pages, you know, you and I can give some commentary on the art or anything that strikes us. But especially, I definitely want to think especially about the writing, since I'm fortunate to be joined by you for this episode. So right away, Omelet opens up with this, I think it's an interesting device, something that he has used before, right? It's got Donald and Daisy and the nephews driving. They're just entering the town of Omelet. And we see that it's population 30. I think that's kind of an important element, right? That it's this tiny little burg.
Oh, absolutely. And
so, you know, to me, this device that he uses is this like passing through town, and he is going to take some time to kind of do a big flashback, right? The meat of this story is going to be this flashback that is told. He's telling it to Daisy, but really he's telling it to the reader. And he uses this great hook, which is the town's goofball name of Omelet. And as Daisy is pondering why on earth it's called Omelet, the nephews and Donald are kind of distracted by donning disguises and having this conversation about, you know, you can't possibly intend to drive through the town. It's not safe. And you know, I love this, right? Daisy is an avatar for the reader who's wondering what the heck is going on.
And absolutely. Yeah.
And they go ahead.
No, that's what I wanted to say about this page is, and you're absolutely right, that Daisy serves as she has a very small role in this story. She's just there at the beginning and at the end. But without Daisy, there is no reason for Donald to do a flashback. And without the flashback, if you told the story just straight, Donald wouldn't be the narrator. And being the narrator really adds something to the story. It gives it says a lot about Donald's attitude and towards the town folk and so forth is revealed in the narration in addition to what happens and so forth. But I could be wrong on this, but it might be the only story where Donald narrates his own story. I
think there's another story that has same structure where he did one of those soft remakes. Do you remember the one? I don't remember the true title, but I think it's called like Mount Mushmore, where it's kind of the same thing where they're driving through and he's explaining about this disaster that he inflicted.
I'm sure you're right. I'm 69 now. I used to be able to keep all 500 plots in my head, and I just can't do it. I don't even remember all of my stories at this point. But
right. I mean, I have the benefit of being an obsessive podcast host, right, and you know, doing these active searches when it's. But you're right. This is a very rare story structure for Karl Barks, and that's part of why this one has to stand out, right? Because it's a great point you made. He's a very reliable narrator, but we hear his attitudes about kind of the town and what happened. And it's great.
This is such a great setup to what goes on. It's very economical. Even though 10 pages, devoting a whole page is quite a bit of percentage of the story, but in the very first panel, you get in the name of the town that is only 30 people, at least only 30 people. Now, it might have been bigger before they had to survive Donald being there. And you get, and if you look at for the readers who aren't following along with the comic in front of them, Daisy has this kind of quizzical look on her beak in that first panel. And then as you watch the panel progression, the kids are explaining, kids and Donald are going like, do we have to go through the omelet and we don't have any other way around? And here's these disguises, and Daisy's eyes get bigger, and there's actual sweat marks coming off of her. I guess that's what they are. And it's so concerned. And she's on the fifth panel. She actually looks kind of frightened. And by the last panel, she's actually looking angry with Donald, like, yes, by all means, explain what's going on. In terms of physical action comedy, there's almost nothing in this page, except it's very funny, and it's all based on reactions. To some extent, Donald pointing out these absurd disguises for himself and the kids. I did want to mention that the sixth panel, and you have Donald and Daisy actually going through the town, and to emphasize what a sleepy, going back to the second panel, you have the town in the background and Donald and Daisy in silhouette, so it really focuses your eye on the town. So you get a sense of location and so forth. And then on that next to the last panel, they're going through the town. And to emphasize what a small, sleepy town it is, there's someone on the side. It's somewhat of a stereotype. It's sleeping, taking a siesta, and there's a dog in the street sleeping, and there's a cat there who's just kind of looking at the dog, and there's a car coming. Oh, how unusual,
Right.
And there's a sign on the wall going cow for sale, which is not what you would get in most communities. It just describes, it tells you so much about this community and so much of it's just a beautiful piece of storytelling setup for the story.
Absolutely. Just a handful of these details. He paints such a great picture in this, really economical. He's only got 10 pages to do this.
And when I started writing comics, one of the best pieces of advice I got from an editor was, don't just have the characters talking and doing stuff. Try to fit in as much as you can. So be very economical. And you're often trying to do two things at the same time. And Barks does this beautifully throughout that first page. So that's all I had to have about that.
Those are great details. I really appreciate that. And I'm going to add that I love the boys' look of apprehension at the last panel. Everything about this first page is so intriguing to the reader. It's not a mystery story, but Barks is setting up this mystery of what the heck happened in Omelet and how is it connected to the ducks?
And I agree that Daisy acts as the reader here. And when I'm sure when I was reading this story the first time, I had the same reaction as Daisy.
Yes.
What the heck is going on? You know, it's just so perfect. Yeah, it's, that's all.
That's perfect. It makes for such a great page turner. So so on the second page, we do start to get kind of the lay of the land, right? And Donald actually presents it as a story. He says the story begins a little over a year ago when I rented that farm on the hill up there. And we get kind of a gradual look at this hilltop farm that the ducks are gonna inhabit for a while. And as you say, we get a great sense of place of Omelet, right? The farm stands quite a bit above the rest of the town. And we learn in this panel where Donald looks really morose or forlorn that the town used to be called Pleasant Valley. So we're building a little bit to what's going to happen. And basically he explains that they intended to, this was one of Donald's get rich schemes. He wanted to become a chicken farmer. What did he say? He said, I'd heard that farmers were getting rich, so I set out to raise chickens. That line cracks me up because you don't generally hear about farmers getting rich, right?
And that was actually, when I reread the story recently, I was going, yes, this is why if nothing else, was why I wanted to do the story, because Carl knew that you didn't get rich becoming a farmer.
Yes.
So it's both a commentary on himself and on Donald. And I personally, Donald's not a very pleasant person throughout this story. And
right.
I think Carl had a great respect. If you look at like the milkman story or the story where he's delivering the mail against blizzards and so forth, Carl had a great respect for the working man and for the particularly people who were doing things every day who didn't get much attention. But I don't think he had much respect for people who wanted to get rich quick.
Yeah.
And I think that's one reason Donald doesn't get he's not a heroic. Occasionally he's a heroic character. He's not in this story.
Right.
He's not at all.
That's a great point. You're right. He really lionizes hard work, but, you know, he hates Gladstone Gander, one of his like most famous characters. You can tell he does not like him. And so, you know, Barks does a great job of just setting up Donald and the nephews, learning the ropes, farming chickens. We see a little bit of passage of time and we learn that the chickens are not growing, or rather they're not laying eggs the way that Donald expects them to. He's just feeding them. We see his little jaunts into the town for supplies. His noisy truck is annoying the locals. We get this sense that they really dislike him being there. And by the end of page two, Donald's become impatient with their slow rate. And he whips up this like concoction of vitamins and minerals to make them lay eggs. Do you mind telling us about some of the things that go into it?
Coal oil, turpentine, mange cure, and heat pills. And this is one of, I think this is the first indication. Actually, going back a panel, can I go back a panel just very briefly?
Absolutely. Anything on this page is game right now.
Okay, he's holding up one of the chickens, and the chicken looks like he's got it by the neck, and he's looking at it. His visage is like pure murder, and the chicken looks very nervous. And I think these chickens need a special diet because they're not laying eggs. And his solution to that is to come up with this special mixture of what he calls vitamins and minerals, or just, it looks like a perfect way to poison someone.
Right.
And this is really the first thing where his get rich feelings sort of manifest themselves in action. And we'll have many other instances of this, but each one of those makes things much worse. So this is the first one.
Right. Yeah. He's really going to sabotage himself in this. So we see the results pretty quickly of this very Barksian concoction he makes. The nephews tell him that the chicken's feathers are really quickly falling out. And I like, John, how he flashes back and forth, right, between the ducks on the farm and down in the town, and the townspeople's reaction to everything. It's a great structure. They see the feathers all gathered there, and they think that they're in for an early snow. And you know, if you think about some of the progression of this, it doesn't really, it falls apart under scrutiny, but it definitely works with like comic book logic, right? I think it's very tight for comic book logic, because this early snow approaching makes them all realize that they need to seal their roofs against rain and snow. And so everyone in town goes out to tar their roofs, which is something that people really, really do or did. I think we probably mostly use other materials now. And by the end of the page, Donald is trying to turn this into something that can benefit him. He realizes, hey, we can gather and sell these feathers to pillow makers.
Yeah. And so Donald has a tendency in this thing to go from, his thoughts go from like A to immediately to Z instead of B. Is C or D, you know, in terms of let's get rich, and he doesn't think things out. So, and I just want to say a couple of things here. One, those poor chickens. It's a wonder they're not dead. Donald's lucky they just lost their feathers. But they're both pathetic looking and frankly kind of funny. Visual. And it's getting to your point about comic book logic. And I know what you mean by that, but I want to break that down. What in comic books, at least in some creators, for some creators, particularly if you're doing humor, if it's not shown on the page, it doesn't exist unless you want it to. And so the villagers, the town people who are down below, looking up and seeing all this white on top of the hill. It's not a mountain, it's a hill. And the fact that they haven't seen any snow coming down, they're all wearing not winter wear. You know, it's not obviously not cold out. They haven't seen any snow, but because we don't see it, they can jump to the conclusion like winter's coming already, you know, early winter coming, you know, it. And then another bit of comic book logic is that everybody in town immediately together is tarring their roof.
Yeah, they have party, like an Amish barn raising or something.
So, yeah, that was, and then to see Donald and the boys raking all the feathers together as if they're leaves, and not really thinking about what might happen afterwards. It's hilarious and comic booky.
Right. It's great. I really appreciate your commentary here. This is exactly why I wanted you to come on. Okay, so if you are versed in kind of the tropes of classic cartoons and Our Gang and Little Rascals and all this classic comedy, you probably already expect what's going to happen when you get a bunch of tar and a bunch of feathers introduced. But I love, John, how even though this is incredibly predictable, the payoff, what's going to happen on the very first fiasco is just magnificent.
And I agree with all that. The only thing I would say is if you're 10 years old and you're reading this, or even as an adult and you're reading through and you're just like, what happens next? You may not think that far ahead, and you wouldn't think it would go as badly as it does.
Right. That's true, because this, you know, I have the benefit of hindsight and thinking right. about the cultural implications of tarring and feathering.
Yeah, and I had the same experience rereading it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so as Donald says, a horrible windstorm came up, and the ducks try to, you know, block off the feathers from blowing away, but the inevitable happens. The feathers all blow down into Pleasant Valley. We see the townsfolk, particularly who we'll learn is the mayor, you know, running for their lives lest they be smothered. And we do see the mayor trip himself into a tub of tar. And one of the women in the town cries out, "Our city, our beautiful village, tarred and feathered." And the great comic stinger at the end of this page is the mayor saying, "If you think that's a calamity, take a look at me, the mayor." and he is exactly as tarred and feathered as you would expect. And as the classic, and everyone knows this, but I should say it out loud, right? Tarring and feathering is like a classic form of, I mean, if you go back far enough, it's like, it's torture, but classically in American society, it's a humiliation against right. someone, usually that you want to run out of town.
Yes. And in real life, it must have just been horrific. But
yes, comic book logic.
Right. But I wanted that panel where the mayor is, he's running down the ladder. Uh-huh. That he has leaned up against the house as the feathers are coming down, and and I looked at that when I was rereading the story, and I gone, oh my God, look at the way he's coming down that ladder. Nobody could possibly come down that ladder safely in real life. And then you see the payoff in the next panel where he can't safely go down right. the ladder. I mean, he's running down the ladder, and you can't run down a ladder, and he just goes, tips right over into the tar. And that's beautiful. That last panel where you see the mayor covered in tar and feathers, that's the second, if you count the opening panel, which is a double panel, this is the second double panel of five in the story. And that's really unusual for Carl to have that many double panels in a 10-page story. It's a lot of space, but it works to emphasize like the punch often at the end of the story, of the page where you're seeing the highlight gag for that section. And it's such a visual story, except for the opening and the closing visual. And this story, I think one of the reasons it's such a favorite for is it almost has an epic sense to it. And I think these additional wide paths help with that.
That's an excellent point. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't pick up on that. But as soon as you said it, I'm like, oh yeah, those full, full width panels, they also, I think, really give you a sense of the town itself, because there's a little bit of breathing room, and it's so important to kind of place us within the town. Mm-hmm. So, that's a great point. And you know, what I was thinking too, when I got to this part, and then I went back to reread it, is I've mentioned the rule of threes on the podcast before. It's like one of those academic things that people who analyze media mention, and it makes them sound smart, but it's really very pedestrian, right? But the rule of threes, it is something that Barks was very good at, right? In comedy, three is the perfect number. It does such a good job of abiding by that. We're going to get the three big catastrophes here, and this is our first of them.
Can we talk about the rule of three for a second?
Please.
Okay. you're right. Three is sort of a classic number. There's another component to it. I don't know if it truly plays into this one, but in comedy writing, well, first of all, if you look at the old animated cartoons, I mean, talking about really early, like 30s sure. and so forth, they would often repeat the same action like three times or so. And part of that was just saving them from having to redraw things and so forth.
Right.
But there is a sort of classic pattern of doing three. But the other part, that from a joke writing standpoint, I just want to define this because I've heard references to rule of three before here on the podcast.
Yes.
When I've listened. But from a joke writing standpoint, rule three comes in somewhat in that what people mean is that you get a pattern with the first two references in a gag. I'm talking about a regular gag. And then the third reference totally breaks that pattern. It's part of the cycle, but in a totally unexpected way. I just wanted to explain what rule three meant in a different context. I'm not sure if that comes in here, although each of the disasters is unique in its own way.
Right.
This is the first big one.
Yeah. And that's a great explanation that I haven't fully fleshed out. I do think sometimes the third is more about the elevation and the escalation of it instead of the subversion.
In the Stuck story, I think probably so. But if you look at the masteries, the brittle mastery stories, which I know you've talked about in another podcast, you know, in the brittle mastery stories, Donald is somehow an expert at something. And he's very pompous and self-assured and kind of maybe a little annoying in each of those. But and then I haven't counted, but you know, the first two, maybe three, and then he breaks the pattern with the end, at the end, where something goes preposterously wrong.
Right.
And so that's sort of an example of the rule three. Even, I don't know if it's necessarily a three in each case, but it's that the thrust of that is very much in that realm. So anyway,
and you're right. There's usually that curveball at the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So on the next page, you know, we transition, and Donald, of course, is still explaining this. He notes that they were pretty unpopular after that point, and they're finding that their money is no longer welcome in Pleasant Valley, and they have to drive all the way to Duckburg for supplies. And it's not improving. They're still not getting the hens to lay eggs. So one of the nephews suggests selling them. And Donald is really annoyed at these chickens. And so he says, that's right. The stew pot is the place for lazy hens. And the ducks, this is going to begin sort of calamity number two, one of the many calamities for the town. They start to drive the chickens out to the market in the manner that you had herd cattle, basically.
Right.
And as you mentioned, we get this great, like, long shot of them driving the chickens through town.
Right. And it's preposterous, the idea of herding chickens. It would be like, and I would love to do a story where this actually happens, where you're trying to herd cats. It's about, that would be even more disastrous, possibly. Herding chickens is great.
Sure. Yeah. It's pretty straightforward, but funny action on that page. So, you know, the next page is really going to be all about the kind of predictable chaos that these chickens are causing. And when they get into town, you know, someone says, where do you Leghorn cowboys think you're going? And he tells them, well, we're going to the railroad station to ship the chickens. And the local says, listen, Dumbbell, you don't drive chickens to market like cattle. You haul them in coops. And you know, I think Barks really likes this kind of humor where you've got people acting like rubes or greenhorns or chichacos, depending on, you know, where you are. And it doesn't really make sense with the nephews. They're usually much smarter than this, but of course we know that he'll adjust their kind of cleverness as needs be for the story.
Yeah. The nephews don't really have a strong place in this role in the story. Donald could have stuck in hired hands and it would have been
just could have been Gus Goose if Barks was of a fan.
That might have even been better. But it could have been almost anybody. And
I mean, this story is basically perfect, so I hesitate to say better.
It's really a Donald versus the villagers.
Right. They're incidental, and we get some of the kind of predictable chaos, but it's still really great to see, you know, chickens walking through cement, chickens messing up a china shop worse than a bull might. A little diner gag where a man says, "Waiter, we ordered our chicken fried, not walking." And they end up having to retreat back up their hill.
Right. Fleeing from the villagers who are so upset.
Right.
I guess it's sixth panel where the chickens are in the china shop. For people who aren't in the from the U.S. There's a term called a bull in a china shop, and Barks is playing with that. The whole idea of having a bull in a china shop, you just know that there's going to be destruction.
Yeah, that's a good point, because it is a good little Americanism. The next page is basically all about the audit of chickens that Donald performs when they get back to the farm. He counts and he realizes that they're missing one of their 10,000 chickens. And so, you know, we've got this funny moment where Donald angrily stalks down into the town, demanding that they return his missing chicken. And it's pretty funny because the mob is they're out for his blood, but Donald, who you mentioned, he's a bit of a jerk. He's a big jerk in this one. He does have the law on his side. And so the townspeople kind of fan out to look for this one chicken. And by the end, we realize that a baker pokes his head out and says, "No need to look further, gentlemen. I've found the chicken." And he angrily points to it being immersed in the dough mixer with his wife, the other baker, crying about 2,000 loaves of bread ruined. And do you want to read Donald's end of the exchange there?
"You should be jailed for not having a lid on that booby trap," which is, you know, so aware of other people's feelings. And the poor chicken, the chicken is just, they've got a chicken in the vat and it's just covered with goop, and there's not a bit of the chicken that you can actually see. And there's a woman in the background she's just sobbing. She's just uncontrollable. And it's an oddly disturbing and funny panel at the same time. My main comment on this, I guess my only other comment really on this, is that panel where they've got a police officer and he's going, "We have to help him find his chicken, much as we hate to do it." And the caption goes, "The law was on my side." And again, this is a good example of why Donald, it's so nice to have Donald narrating this. But what that panel made me think about when I was rereading this is Donald is, if you transposed Uncle Scrooge's personality onto Donald, that's what's happening. Donald is always concerned about the bottom line. He's not really concerned about anybody else. And he's always concerned about making money and his property and so forth. And Uncle Scrooge, Donald is my favorite character. I like Uncle Scrooge, but he's not really the most pleasant person. But Donald is essentially Uncle Scrooge in this story.
Yeah, that's a great catch. You're right. I can totally imagine Scrooge posed in that shot. The other thing, there's a menacing little detail that there's a noose hanging in the background that that
you're right.
The townspeople clearly they're a lynch mob, which is is disturbing. And of course, you know, historically that there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't see that today, but it was a common trope that was used in comedy as well and it's funny that they're out for blood and the policeman there is basically the only one saving Donald. All right, boy, each of these pages is such a nice, tight little almost episode in this short story. The next page kind of deals with the aftermath here. Donald explains the townspeople sued me, and Barks shows him in front of one of Barks's like wise owl judges, being found liable for $900 damage. And there's a silver lining, though. The nephews explain. I really should read it in the progression because the pacing is so strong here. They say, don't be downhearted, Uncle Donald. We've got good news for you. And he says, what could be good news? And they explain, the chickens have started to lay eggs. You know, the reader is basically forgotten at this point because Barks has distracted us with so much.
Right.
And so that turns the story around a little bit. Donald is really excited and he goes up to the homestead to calculate. And again, a great bit of dialogue. He's scribbling furiously. Barks occasionally does these great calculation gags. Umpteen tons of feed at 570 per CWT, 10,000 eggs per day divided by 12 and X by 7. And he calculates that they need $1 a dozen for the eggs to break even. And unfortunately, the price is at 40 cents at that point. And so they engage in some speculation where they store these massive amounts of eggs. They start storing them until the house bulges, waiting for the price to go up.
Yeah. again, going for the bottom line, although it's understandable in that situation. But I guess just a little bit that I want to annotate sort of there. When I was first reading this story, is so the panel where he's got the wise owl and the owl's pointing at Donald and he's going, I find Donald Duck liable for $900 damages, and Donald's going, playing highway robbery. And I love the two panel progression where Donald's excited, kind of a smile on his face as he's doing the figures and he's expecting to come up that he's gonna make a fortune. And then the next panel, he gets the results and, oh, we've got to get $1 a dozen for eggs to break even. I mean, just between the expressions on his face to me are quite funny. Yeah. And the only other thing on that is on the next to the last panel, they've got all these eggs and crates, and they've moved the stove out of the house
right, to
make more room, and the house is bulging. There's no room to go in, and it's literally bulging. I just think that's very funny.
It's some great comedic art. It is. And you mentioned the expressions. I'm glad you did, because if you look at every panel on this page, every expression is so radically different and so expressive. Sure. And I mean, he was such a master at this. All right, so we're getting up to that final disaster here, right? we have some transition. The passage of time, the eggs are piling up again. Cartoon logic, the story is brisk. We're not going to think too hard about how long these eggs are going to last outside like this. I gather that like high quality eggs, you actually can keep them shelf stable and don't need to refrigerate them for a while, but I'm guessing not for weeks and weeks. But anyway, they're accumulating them. The price is gradually climbing. And they say that Donald says it's about time. There must be 1 million eggs in that mountain. And eventually the ducks hear an ominous creaking, and it is the bulkhead giving away. Bulkhead would have been a good vocabulary word for me as a kid. and then we transition down to the town to get the perspective of these eggs all coming down the mountain. A couple of horrified looking townsfolk. One says, "Oh, my living soul." And we get that. We get the panel that we've kind of been anticipating, right? It's got a great onomatopoeia spluk as the town is just utterly inundated by this million eggs crashing into the valley.
Yeah. And it's sort of, it's another double wide panel. And it, instead of being a splash panel, it's a spluk panel. and notably, I mean, I think you're supposed to imply, understand this, because this is a Disney comic, nobody's going to die in it. And you see a bunch of, you see the town folk on the other hill climbing up out of the way. And I think you're supposed to feel that all of them magically got out of town. And so nobody's harmed or killed in all this.
Sure. And, it was probably picnic day or something.
Right. and I, the only other thing I wanted to say is, and is, has there ever been a worse way to store eggs?
I know.
Piling a million of them on the top of a hillside with a board in the way of them going
Absolutely.
Down.
Yeah. This is such a great payoff, right? Like, and we're not supposed to think too hard about, you know, why can't we see the shells and so on. And, you know, I always assumed everyone got out okay, but it's just, he has done such a good job of setting up the progression of the story and the geography of it that it just, it lands so well. But we're not done yet. We have one more page where we get the actual payoff, which is that the town convenes their disaster council. The ducks flee for their lives as they must. And they decide, they determine that the eggs are too, basically they're too wet, they're too runny. I like to imagine that they can't actually siphon them up because they're just like too viscous. They're not a regular liquid. So they mm-hmm. the only way that they can move that mass of eggs is to cook them. And he says, and to cook them, we'll have to, and I think this is the mayor, says, set the town afire. And so we see Donald explains the villagers fried the eggs the hard way. The mayor comments, I never dreamed that I, the mayor, would burn down the city hall. There's a little aside about it being assured. I'm going to guess that an adjuster probably wouldn't approve of this, but again, this is comic book logic. And so the poor townspeople watch and say, our beautiful village is Pleasant Valley no more. When we build again, we'll have to give our town a new name. And so we have indeed found out the story of why that burg is called Omelette. And John, do you mind giving us the little comic stinger at the end, the last two panels?
Okay, so we're back out of the flashback, and they're leaving. Donald and Daisy and the boys are leaving Omelette, and they're talking about, and so that's why Omelette got its name. And Donald goes, but you would think those storeheads could have spelled it omelette with an E at the end or something fancy. After all, those were mighty expensive eggs. And that's the end. It's kind of a soft ending. It's in an odd way, it's sort of a Van Horn ending based on our, and it's just a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of emotional, this is what I'm thinking about. And it's a very soft ending, but it's kind of appropriate. All this angst and action and so forth. Yeah, it was just a neat little story. I'm actually very surprised that this story in some ways got approved by its Carl editor.
Right.
Although Carl did a lot of things that you could not get away with today. I think Carl probably got more leeway than a lot of creators, because
he had a lot of goodwill for his output, I've got to imagine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was one of their stars for sure. He didn't necessarily know that, but they did. And right. Going back, yeah, there was a panel in retrospect to getting away with things. There's that panel, I think, on the second page where he's holding the chicken by the throat and the chicken's looking very nervous and so forth. You could never get away with that in what is supposedly a kid's comic,
right?
These days. And you certainly couldn't get away with it in a Disney comic anymore. It's not in the last few years. There have been sort of a change in how
right
things are what's approved these days. And he just got away with a lot in this story. But it totally works. And sometimes you have to prod the edge and go over a little bit to make something really memorable.
Yeah, very well said, I think. And you mentioned it's a soft ending, but to me it feels like that penultimate beat, you know, the conclusion is such a doozy that it you got to kind of exhale at the end there, I think.
Right.
So that was really good. We had a lot of great things, I think, to say about this. I know we've already talked about this, right? I think I'm in agreement with you that this is certainly an all-time great. What are your overall thoughts that maybe we didn't cover about what makes this such a special 10-pager?
I think we covered pretty much what I thought.
Yeah.
I have some additional, as I said, one of the reasons I wanted to pick this story is because it's such a good window into how Carl created stories. And Carl had an animation background. He was in the story department at Disney doing Donald Duck shorts. And I think his way of doing comic books was probably the same way he did animated stories, where he would he would have a setting or an idea of what he wanted to do in a story. And you've probably heard this too, but
By all means.
He wanted to draw snow. No, nobody wants to draw snow, but he wanted to do a certain type of story or a certain setting. And so he would come up, he would write as many gags as he could think of to go with that setting or that flow of action. And then he would try to fit them into some kind of chronology, he would finalize the story based on how the gags fit together. And it would influence, I'm sure, how the story progressed in terms of content in so many ways. It doesn't sound like a very literary way to create a story, but if you're doing humor, it works really well. And this is so important, if you have a really good sense of structure, you can do this. If you don't have a good sense of structure, then it's just chaos. But Carl had that sense of structure. And in this case, he had three main things that go wrong. And then within them, particularly in that second one, he has many gags within the meta gag. The chicken and the batter, the
right
ball, the chickens in the china shop and so forth. And I just thought, maybe more than most stories, this is such a clear example of that. So that was one reason I wanted to pick this story.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's so much kind of nested within, right? Because he's got he's got this like classic bookend structure. Right, he's right. He does a great job of the bookends. He's got kind of the rule of three progression. He's got the mini gags within the rule of three. And even within the mini gags, sometimes he has these little reaction shots. Even the expressions are funny. They're almost like mini gags within themselves.
Or a little, yeah. Or like the sign on the judge's bench and so forth. He like just throw away gags in the background. I mean, he just fits in so much.
Right. It's so funny, but so tight. It is. It's a great story. I didn't get to read this one until pretty late because I missed a lot of the reprints and didn't like find it until later when I was kind of filling in those holes in my collection. And I was like, wow, I can't believe I've never seen this one. But it's such a standout story to me. And I've already alluded to this, right? But this is very well regarded by the overall duck community. We always talk about how these stack up on Indux compared to other stories. And, you know, you're another creator. I should preface this by saying, of course, Indux is like an imperfect measurement and it's going to be biased towards like creators like Barks that people are the most familiar with and these stories that are sticky, but it is a good gauge of like just how the community feels about the stories. And this one this has a rank as of when I was making my notes, at least it had a 7.7 out of 10, which is good for number 157 out of all, you know, 42,000 Disney comics that are Disney stories that are ranked on the site.
And that's very high for a 10 pager because most fans are going to prefer the adventure stories.
Yes. That's a great point, right? Those are much more memorable. I just for that reason, a couple of times I kind of plucked out the 10 pagers and I compared them to each other. So if you're just looking at his 10 pagers on their own list, then this one generally clocks in at about number 7 or so.
Okay,
so,
that's interesting because I had a note. I looked at another site, cbarks.lettercbarks.dk.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No, that's a great resource, definitely.
Oh, it is. And it's an amazing resource. And they have ratings for the stories too, but they, whoever does it, has a different approach. If I understand it right, what he or she does is they look at how many times the story has been reprinted,
right?
Which is a different measure.
Yeah, another great way of looking at it.
This is worldwide. I assume it probably has changed since it was first posted. But let's see. This comes in as in for the comics and stories, the 10 pagers. This comes in number 5 out of 10, out of the top 10.
Nice.
I'll just mention a few other. Flipism ties for number 9, and some of my own favorites that are on here. And Master Rainmaker is number 6. And Statuesque Statues, which they call Statues Galore, number 4. I know you did a broadcast that had that in it.
Right.
And they have... I'm a little hard pressed to go with a definitive favorite, but if I had to pick one, I would go, and you've already done it, or I would have requested it.
Sure.
But the Lemonade story with first appearance of Gladstone.
Yeah. Wintertime Wager. Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably my favorite. That clocks in as number 2 on this list. And then for the most reprinted stories was the Money Bin Crib, where Scrooge is storing all his money in a crib and Herc Tornado whips,
right.
whips it out and redistributes so that everybody becomes rich. That's number one. So I mean, I didn't like them all, but I was gratified to see so many of my favorites show up in the top 10.
Yeah, and I think there's a sort of canon among fans, right? There's some pretty broad agreement on the top like 10 or top 20 or so. Everyone's going to kind of position them bit different, but I think you ask any Duck fan, sure, this has got to be a top 10 story somewhere around there. I mean, I here and there, I have a couple of them that I would probably quibble with. It's fun to share this. I'll share this list as part of the release for this one, and people can debate / argue over it. Okay. But I think broad consensus, right? This is an all-time great story. If you haven't read this one, it's really like, what are you doing? Go ahead and read it. And don't listen to this podcast until you do.
I will say, you know, when I've listened to this podcast, sometimes I don't have time. I'm just listening and I don't have time to look at the stories. It's so much richer if you're following along and reading the stories.
Yeah.
I think it's probably a coincidence, but it's interesting to me that two of Carl's best stories are about eggs.
Yeah.
The other one being Lost in the Andes, which many people consider his very best story, with the square eggs. I'm sure he did some other stories where eggs played a part, but maybe Easter egg story. Anyway.
Yeah. Definitely has to be in the conversation. Well, you know, this has been a real pleasure, John. I really appreciate you joining me. Before we wrap up, we covered this pretty thoroughly, right? There are almost too many great panels in this one to do this feature. But are there any favorite panels that you would like to highlight that we didn't already get to kind of call attention to?
Well, there's some that I've mentioned that I really like. I will mention, you know, a lot of the splash panels or the sploop panels are ones I particularly enjoyed. One thing we didn't talk about is the number of silhouette panels in this thing.
Yeah, I was actually just looking at one. So yeah, go for it.
Yeah, there's Barks. I mean, I don't remember his editor's name, but apparently Barks's editor was telling his artist to go heavy on black placements. You know, not all artists think about placing strong blacks in their pieces, but Barks was sort of unique in how he used his silhouettes. And there's the big reason for using silhouettes is to save yourself from drawing so much.
Right.
And I haven't mentioned it, but the thing I'm doing the most these days, I'm doing a funny webcomic called Last Kiss, where I'm using.
Yeah, I was going to encourage you to plug that at the end, and I talked over you there. So say it again. No.
Well, Last Kiss, which happened because I bought rights to an old series called First Kiss, but I take old comic book art, and mostly romance, but not totally. And I redialogue it and I do it online, and it's on Go Comics, which is a big website. And my own website is lastkisscomics.com. Don't go to lastkiss.com, go to lastkisscomics.com. And anyway, in the romance comics, particularly from Charlton, there's a huge number of silhouettes. And I know it's because the artists were just trying to save time. Carl certainly was trying to save time, but he used them so artistically. And sometimes it's like that first silhouette where Donald and Daisy are in the car, you would have gotten no benefit from him drawing in their characters from the back. And a lot of the other reason to have silhouettes is, besides the artistry of it, is to focus on the things that are not in silhouette. And Barks was the master of that. And there's a large number of silhouettes here. And I think the next silhouette is just Donald going up the hill after on
the grumble gripe one.
Yeah.
That's and so funny to me. I was going to mention that one too.
Right. And you would have got, and you couldn't have done a close up because you wouldn't have been able to tell he was going out of town, or you could have, but it just wouldn't have been as effective. And he was so good at that. And we could just talk about that. And some of the characters in some of the panels are drawn, the town folk are drawn in silhouette, and that panel with the noose, they're two of the characters, and you don't need to see them. You see them in silhouette with clubs in their hands. And it's such a strong statement of what they're thinking and what they want to do. You just wouldn't have gotten anything else. And it focuses you on everything else in the panel too. So I just wanted to bring up the silhouettes.
Yeah, that's a good one to mention because he uses them in these really stark contemplative moments a lot. And you really see that on the last page where the ducks that are, as they're fleeing there in silhouette, as the townspeople gaze on their burning town there in silhouette. And then that final capper, you know, the ducks are leaving town again in silhouette. They are really great. Otherwise, it's kind of all the same. The panels that you might mention as favorite, they really are very predictable. In this, right. It's all of the really spectacular, catastrophic things that happen. But I really want to again call attention to the expressions, especially as you see them on what was that page? But you mentioned his sneer at the chicken that he is holding by the neck, but also his changing expressions on that I think that eighth page were just incredible. A great example of that merging of his art and his writing, storytelling.
Oh, I just noticed something a little different, but you know, we talked about the chicken being held by the neck. I think it's on page six where the townsman is holding Donald by the neck.
Yes, that's a good point.
It's just a little good reverse action, he's telling him about how you have to haul chickens and coops and so forth. That was just a nice little reverse bit there.
Yeah, it's a great touch. All right, any anything else that you'd like to mention before we wrap it up?
We've covered this. If anybody could cover it more, I don't know how.
That's right. Well, John.
No. I just thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to get to talk to you about this great story and to get to wax on about, you know, when I was 9 and 10 and reading a lot of stories that you wrote. This is another one that I read till it was dog-eared. Yeah. That's a big favorite of mine. No Room for Human Error, the robot one. Can I ask?
Go ahead.
Are there any lines that like really stand out to you that you're just really really glad that you wrote? You know what in the Duck comics specifically?
I can't quote any of them, but I can tell you I'm particularly proud of some of the rhyming I did in some of them, where I'd like Stampede and Deliver, where he's doing a like singing the motto
the motto of this of the company, where he's got to deliver a pizza, and I don't remember if it's 30 minutes or 60 minutes, and he's doing that. And I did that in the remake, Somewhere Beyond Nowhere, at what he's delivering. I'm particularly proud of those. I can't quote any of them, but I'm perversely proud of that comic you just held up, No Room for Human Error, which was a long story for me. And someone pointed out to me, a friend pointed out to me, that I actually decapitated a character in the comic.
Right.
It's probably the only time a character has been decapitated. True, it was a robot, but it was a thinking, talking, sentient robot.
I loved all of the robots' dialogue in that. This is going to cut us off in a moment, but can I tell you, you have in this one, you have Scrooge say, "Oh, deliver me from bewilderment." And I love that little aside there. I love the alliteration you do. Listeners, thank you for joining us
for this very special episode of the 10-Page Podcast. Feel free to reach out to us on the socials at Barks Remarks, and we'll talk at you next time.